Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Hello and welcome to Mormon Stories. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and we are to embark on another series focusing on mental health and relationships. This episode is meant to piggyback my most recent interview with Sarah regarding postpartum depression. Tonight I have with me Jamie Bodily, who is a certified birth doula and has been helping mothers and babies for the past 9 years. Jamie initiated, co-wrote, and coordinated a doula program for women in recovery from substance addiction, where she's had great success. She's worked extensively helping mothers with a variety of mood disorders and is in the internship phase of her master's program for a degree in mental health counseling. Although, am I correct, Jamie, in that you're now currently done with that as of today or yesterday?
As of yesterday, I'm a graduate. So.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thanks.
So you have a master's degree now in mental health counseling.
Yes.
And you have a master's degree also in human services from Capella University. And you received your bachelor's degree in family sciences from Brigham Young. Jamie has specifically focused on reproductive mental health during her internships and has had the opportunity to work with Dr. Diane Sanford, who's an expert in the field. She has 5 children and is a member of our church. And with that introduction, I'd just like to say welcome, Jamie.
Thank you, Natasha.
And again, congratulations. That's a huge accomplishment.
Thanks.
All right. So why don't we get started with you just giving us a little bit more of your background and how you kind of got interested in this field to begin with, and just fill in any information I left out as far as your journey, as far as how you got to where you are today.
So I became a doula about 9 years ago. I'd had a very rough second birth. I had a doctor that was impatient with the process and ended up with a lot of things I did not want going into that birth. And I knew something had to be different, but I didn't know what would change it. And I ended up with postpartum depression myself for quite a while. I was untreated, undiagnosed, so I know what it's like to be on that end of it.
Did you, at the time, did you know, could you label it as postpartum depression? Did you know what that was and that you were suffering from
that? I had a social worker from the hospital call and asked me if I was depressed, but I could not accept that label and wasn't going to accept it.
Okay.
So I was resistant to it.
Okay. And going back to the second birth that you described then, do you feel that the relationship you had with your doctor and that things not going the way you had planned or hoped, that that maybe played into the depression?
Absolutely. I mean, this baby was, we had a hard time getting pregnant. We'd had secondary infertility issues. And so had to use fertility drugs to get pregnant. So this was a very wanted pregnancy. And yeah, the whole thing falling apart just really made it hard to enjoy being a mom. And it was, but I thought, you know, it was what I wanted. So it really threw me for a loop.
Can you give me some details as to what went wrong or what you didn't, what were some of the things that you didn't want to have happen that happened during that birth delivery?
I had really wanted an unmedicated birth and had done the preparation for that unmedicated birth. When I got to the hospital, things were going really well. My husband was doing a great job supporting me, and he got hungry. It had gone into the morning hours. It had gone on for a while. So he asked where the vending machine was, and the nurse had been kind of pushing the epidural for a while, and I kept saying, no, no, no. She sent him around the hospital when there was a vending machine down the hall. And while he was gone, I just lost my ability to do this by myself and asked for the epidural. And once that happened, my labor slowed. And then in that time, the doctor came in and had a golf game and wanted to get to his golf game. And so they basically did a high forceps delivery of my child.
Okay. So not in line with kind of your birth plan and...
Not at all what I had prepared for.
Okay. So then how does that experience catapult you forward into becoming a doula?
During my third birth, I was assigned a doula when I arrived at the hospital. And she was absolutely amazing. She got my husband very involved in the process. She was paying attention to me. She helped me advocate when I had people telling me that they couldn't follow my birth plan. She really went to bat and made sure it was followed. For me, it turned things around.
Okay.
It gave me back the confidence I lost.
For the benefit of our listeners, I don't think I hear you saying that you're anti-epidural or anti-other things. It was just really more the idea that you had a certain birth plan in place and that birth plan wasn't followed or respected as far as you were concerned.
Right. Those were just my choices and what I had wanted.
Right. So then tell me a little bit more about this doula experience. They just assigned her to you. That was part of what the hospital had as far as their services, like you hadn't planned on having a doula?
I hadn't planned on having a doula, but she was assigned to me when I walked in the door, and
wow.
It was great. I mean, it was wonderful.
That's a pretty progressive hospital then, I think, that you were going to.
Right.
And what was that experience like?
It was amazing. I mean, it was a fabulous experience. She got my husband to pay full attention to me. She got the medical staff to really listen to what I wanted. And I was thrilled.
And then from that experience forward, did you have postpartum depression with that third child or not?
I had some situational depression, but it, you know, that passed as the situation passed. So I would say yes, but I know what was going on. And as soon as that situation cleared, I was fine.
Okay. And so then how did that kind of move you forward to becoming a doula yourself then?
I just thought I had to give that back to other women. It was just an amazing gift. And I started researching. It took me a couple of years to get all my money together and do the thing, the training and all of that. But that's what I've been doing for the last 9 years.
Okay. Can you walk us through the training? What does that entail? What are the certification involve? And
so you go through, it can be 2 days or 3 days, depending on which organization you're working with. And I went through a 3-day training. So you do that live. There's a lot of hands-on activities, a lot of education, lots of videos, lots of just learning what happens to the woman in labor, in the most normal physiological sense, and the spiritual and the psychological impact of birth.
Did you have to have any pre-qualifications, I mean, any type of nursing background or anything like that, or this 3-day workshop was, or certification was what the only thing that you needed as far as moving forward from there?
No, there's no nursing background, because a doula simply provides informational and emotional support to the laboring woman. So I never do a blood pressure check or a fetal heart tone check. I don't do any cervical checks. I'm totally there for her and to help her achieve her goals. And then after you take the class, you have a very long reading list.
A very long reading list?
A very long reading list.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of books on normal pregnancy, breastfeeding, supporting the mom. There's just a variety of topics that you read up on.
Okay.
And then there is a post test that you take that you should know after the reading. You attend a childbirth education class as an observer. And then you do 3 births. And these births have to meet very specific qualifications. So for most doulas, it takes at least 6. I think for me, it took 10 to 12 to meet all the qualifications they wanted. So it took a bit of time, but it was well worth the investment.
Okay. And then is this something then that you work through a hospital, or what kind of setting is it that you decide to work through?
Well, when I started, I did private work. So couples would contact me and hire me as their doula. And then we would work prenatally through the postpartum period together. At one point, my girlfriend called. She had applied for a job at a substance abuse treatment facility. And she didn't want it. She said, I can't, in my heart of hearts, this isn't the population for me. And I know it. but I think you'd be great. So I went and interviewed, and they offered me the job. And I kind of thought, oh, I don't know if this is my population either. I've never worked with women in recovery. I don't know much about it. But I took the job anyways and found out that I really enjoyed it and really found that there was a lot of need for these services in this population.
So going back to when you were in private practice and couples would contact you about wanting a doula, is this something that their insurance companies would help reimburse for, or is this something that mostly people were paying for on their own?
You know, 9 years ago, it was very hard to get an insurance company to even look at it. Now, there are doulas getting reimbursement through various insurance companies, and there are some states where Medicaid will cover it.
Okay.
So couples just kind of have to really research that part of it.
And then the certification process that you did, who are the organizations that are offering that type of certification?
The three major organizations are DONA, which used to be, it's DONA International, DONA. And then you have CAPA, which is CAPPA. And you have Two Labor.
Like the number two and then labor after that?
No, it's TO and then all capital LABOR.
Okay. And which one of those did you go through?
I went through Two Labor.
Okay. So then going back to this job that you took as working in this addiction treatment center, can you tell us a little bit about your experience there?
I found that I really enjoyed working with this population, that there was a huge need. The addictions field is very good at working with substance abuse. They know that, and they know how to work with it. But there's not a lot of people trained in the pregnancy and postpartum aspect of bringing a woman from being addicted to becoming a mother and what happens in this whole process. And I found that I had to study a lot. I had to work really hard to get the knowledge base. But as I've done this, it's just been, I find that it makes a huge difference in the outcomes for the women and children.
And this is a This is a treatment center that offers then therapy, probably the 12-step type of programs, and then also attached to that are services like these for women who are becoming mothers.
Right. So the facility I started at was a residential facility housing 26 women and their children. And they lived on the site in they were called cottages. And they had their own room, own bathroom. Each room had a crib and all the things they needed for their baby.
So this was inpatient.
This was inpatient long term. So most of them were coming out of a criminal justice system, out of jail, with the chance to do treatment instead of jail time.
Yeah. And you saw the success rate being positive as far as you felt like the treatment was successful, and you saw women being able to kind of move forward in their lives in a positive way?
Yes. And these children were able to have, they were able to be born substance free, which is huge, which takes out a lot of disadvantages for them. And then their moms were bonding with them, which of course we want to see. And so lots of good results when the women were motivated to work with their treatment, which was most of the time.
Well, it sounds like fascinating work. Is this what you're still doing? Is this where you're still working at this point?
Well, we moved to Missouri because my husband got a job promotion. And at that point, I applied to several treatment facilities, and I ended up getting a job working with the children at Queen of Peace Center in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay. Where was this that you were working at the Substance Abuse Center before? What state was that in?
The first one was in Arizona.
Okay.
And I worked here for a while. I had to take a leave of absence for various reasons. And during that leave of absence, I found that there was a grant open for a doula program. And I called the operations director. We had 5 days to get a federal grant in. And he said, I'm really interested in a program, but I don't know. 5 days is not much time to write a grant. He said, let me see what I can do. And in about 15 minutes, he had a grant team assembled, ready to go to work. And we wrote and wrote and wrote, and we got it.
Wow. Had he ever written a grant before?
Had I ever written a grant?
Yeah. Or been involved in that type of a process?
No.
No. Wow. That's pretty impressive. And so what was the grant given for?
The grant covered 2 years of doula services to our women in treatment. So we had three full-time doulas who worked to assist these women from whenever they entered the treatment program through their postpartum phase.
And this is now in St. Louis, in the St. Louis area.
Well, unfortunately, we did not get refunded for our next year of funding. Mm. So the program came down in September.
Okay. Okay.
But if anybody wants to donate, we'd love to get it back up.
Sure. Okay. And this is working in this children's center that you were speaking of?
Actually, it's addictions treatment. So I moved, once the doula grant came through, I moved over to working with the moms.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. Anything else you want to share about your professional life, or are we ready to move on to postpartum depression and your understanding of that?
I think we're ready to move on.
Okay. So I think I'd like to start with you being able to give kind of a basic maybe idea of what it is to have, what it should be like from a normal perspective, with normal kind of in quote unquote, after the birth of a child. What can a woman and her spouse or partner or family kind of be able to look at as part of just normal recovery and the struggles that go along with that, that wouldn't be considered postpartum depression?
Okay. So in understanding postpartum adjustment, it's really important to understand what the placenta does during pregnancy. The placenta stores a lot of the hormones. And as pregnancy progresses, the hormone levels increase of progesterone and estrogen to very high levels. And the placenta is storing all this good stuff. And so a lot of times, even moms who may experience depression sometimes feel very good as the pregnancy progresses, just due to the influx of hormones.
Meaning women who experience depression before pregnancy.
Right. Not everybody, but some women feel very good through their pregnancy and don't have problems that they've had before. Then at the time of delivery, the placenta separates from the wall and, of course, is delivered just after the baby. So when that's delivered, all those hormones go with it. So a woman goes from having this very high level, the highest level she's ever had in her life, and within 72 hours, she's going through a crash because she's at preconception levels, which is why the majority of women will experience some baby blues. It's that shift in hormones, and you move from progesterone to prolactin to start producing milk. So there's this huge shift, and they're different hormones, so they do different things. And women definitely feel that shift in their body.
Hmm. Okay.
So there's a hormonal aspect to what we're feeling. You also figure, too, that for most women during delivery, in order to manage the sensations of contractions and all the things that are going on, our body produces endorphins. And those endorphins make us feel pretty good, and they help to relieve some of the pain that they feel during labor. So when they pick up that baby, all these endorphins are flowing and going. And, of course, those go down as time goes on, too. So, again, our body's doing a lot of things that really affect how we feel. And then we add that, you know, in the hospital, we've got lots of support and people are helping us. For most women, the milk doesn't come in till the third day postpartum, which is just when they're going home. So they haven't had a lot of pain associated with the engorgement and the things that go with breastfeeding. And then they go home and all the help is gone for the most part.
And the milk comes in.
And the baby doesn't sleep as well because baby's starting to wake up now. And all these shifts are happening. So it's really normal to feel feelings of being overwhelmed. It's easy to have the sleep deprivation where you're just irritable and not yourself. Those things are somewhat normal. They should start to pass as life moves forward, of course. and crying a little bit. I mean, crying at a Hallmark commercial, crying at the Huggies commercial, those are kind of normal things.
Right.
But if they keep going on and they're not easing up over time or with a little bit of additional help and support, that could be a clue that postpartum depression is happening.
And what time frame are you looking at? Like, what's the normal baby blues adjustment period look like?
By 2 weeks, should be starting to feel at least a good bit better. If you continue to have more bad days than good days, at that point, it's probably good to have an assessment done by a professional.
And what's the best place to go and be able to do that? Do you go back to your OBGYN? Do you call your primary care physician? What's the best place to start asking for help?
It's going to depend really on what state you're in. If you're in New Jersey, all OBGYNs screen with the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Screening Tool. And so they can definitely manage that. And there's a clearinghouse that handles, if it comes up positive, getting connected and referred to professionals in this field. If you live in states that aren't so progressive, it may be best to go to a counselor first or to a psychologist who has experience in reproductive mental health. Also, on my website at parentscount.com, in the handout section, is the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Screening Tool. It's a self-screening tool, and the instructions for scoring it are on the bottom.
So women could take that on their own and kind of assess themselves in a way.
Right, and then if it's showing that there is a problem, they can go to a clinical professional having some information in their hand as to what's happening.
Okay. So why don't you go into more of the classic symptoms of postpartum depression? What is it that women with postpartum depression are typically feeling? What are the diagnostic criteria that go along with that?
So they're a lot like normal depressive symptoms and might include feelings of anger or irritability. They might feel a lack of interest in the baby. They do the normal things to care for their baby, but they have a hard time making that really good connection or feeling really connected to the baby. And I just want to point out that not every mom feels the, oh my gosh, my baby, as soon as the baby's born. For some moms, it's a process of bonding with their baby. But this is when moms just really don't want to connect much at all.
And do you find that when that happens, there's usually guilt associated with that? Like they're not falling into what the cultural norm is, that we kind of have the expectation that women will automatically bond with their child?
Yes, there's a lot of guilt that women feel when this is happening, and they don't understand why.
And is there also, do you see some maybe judgments being passed by, or concerns being passed by the spouse or the family members, if they're noticing that with a mom, that there's a lot of anxiety around that kind of stuff?
It definitely can be. And in some families, it's just not noticed, which is, you know, it's very hard because it does affect the baby. Because the baby's cognitive development depends on the mom interacting with the baby. The baby's emotional regulation depends on that interaction. Which is why it's so important to catch these as soon as possible and get treatment and help.
Right. Okay. So back to your diagnostic criteria. Sorry to interrupt you.
You're fine. A mom might also have a very low appetite or a very high appetite, just like we might see with depression. We're eating more or less depending on what's going on.
And that can be easily confused, especially if you're having more appetite with the fact that you're breastfeeding now and maybe you're thinking, well, I'm just eating more because I'm producing all this milk.
Right. And sleep disturbances. I mean, and this is a hard one because, again, if you're breastfeeding, your baby's getting up every 2 to 3 hours. And so are you just sleep fatigued, or are you really you've got insomnia and are not sleeping well at all? And I think it's real important for moms that have a history of depression to know, to plan ahead of this and think how they're going to get a good night's sleep at least 2 to 3 times a week, because it makes a huge difference.
What are some suggestions for that?
A lot of times moms will have dad take the baby if he's got a flexible work schedule where that will work, and she'll pump once in the middle of the night just to keep her supply up. But dad is feeding the baby from the bottle. Dad has the baby all night when the baby gets up and is allowing mom that good 8 hour period of sleep.
And how often do you find husbands being willing to do this? Is this something that are you seeing most husbands being willing to help in this way? Or do you find that some resistance in that?
If they know that there's been a history of depression, I found dads are amazingly fabulous. Or if mom is just really having a hard time and it's a suggestion that may work, they're really open to it. If dad doesn't have that flexible work schedule or travels a lot, there's nurses, there's nannies, there's postpartum doulas who can come in and do the same thing.
What about women who can't afford that?
Sometimes, and this is tricky because, of course, you got to work with the insurance company, but sometimes with a mental health diagnosis, they will pay for those services.
Okay. Yeah, and then, of course, there's a lot of women, I'm sure, who are uninsured as well. So these are all topics that probably have some socioeconomic issues related with them. You know, the more economic freedom you have, the more you're going to have resources available to you to help you with these kinds of things, I'm assuming.
Right. Absolutely. And of course, you know, we have the crying and sadness that would go with any depression, but you also have some moms who just don't seem to sleep. They just seem like they're driven by a motor. So either way, it can be an indication of depression. And a lot of people get that confused, you know, that it's not always just feeling down in the dump. Sometimes it's just this abundance of energy that mom doesn't even know what to do with. And she doesn't even feel good having it. You know?
Almost like a manic episode in a way.
Right.
What would you say is the likelihood if a woman has had a history of depression in her past? What is that tied to? The likelihood of her having postpartum depression? And along with that question, what about women who've never had an episode with depression but then only seem to have it postpartum?
So both those play. If there's a personal or family history of mental health, so depression, anxiety, or postpartum depression with sisters and mothers, the woman's risk is definitely higher that she could get this disorder. And for many women, the first history or the first incidence of this is postpartum.
Meaning that they haven't had a major depressive episode before this.
Right.
And then do you find that people who have postpartum depression are then more likely to have major depressive episodes later in life, even without another pregnancy?
I haven't seen that in the research. They are more at risk in the next pregnancy.
Okay. So if you only have depression during postpartum, then those are probably the more likely times that you're going to have to worry about it again.
Right. It seems to be in many ways connected with all the hormonal shifts that are going on. Although that is not the only risk factor, of course.
Right. So, are you able to share some kind of examples of women who have struggled with postpartum depression and some of the things that you've seen as far as, you know, more personal examples?
So what we know is that nutrition plays a big part in how our body functions just generally. So when women are able to balance the protein and carbohydrates that they take in at every meal, that does seem to help things out, because a lot of women, when they get into the depressive state, they're eating mostly carbohydrates because those are the comfort foods. And with that, the body just isn't producing what it needs to be able to recover properly, because childbirth is a lot of work.
So upping the protein.
Mm-hmm. Trying to balance those out at each meal.
Okay.
We know that when women are dehydrated, they have more anxiety. So if moms can definitely keep hydrated, that helps. It's another way that they can do things for themselves. Exercise is fabulous. The research shows that it does a very good job at helping to ease depression. But It has to be used just like medication. You have to be regular in your time. You have to be regular at doing it every day. It takes a huge commitment to make that work.
Especially
But
with a
for
new
women,
baby.
yeah, and for women who are very dedicated and don't want to use medication, it can be a very good option. But again, it takes the support and the encouragement of people willing to take the baby while she's doing it and being consistent.
And then there's usually a 6-week process where the doctor's saying you shouldn't be exercising anyway, or I forget what the weeks are, but that seems to sound right to me anyway.
Right, around 6 weeks is when they have the postpartum checkup. So they don't want them doing a whole lot
Of exercise before then.
Right.
So as far as things, more natural ways of trying to deal with this is obviously you mentioned the sleep, getting people to maybe help you with the baby at night, getting, you know, an 8-hour stretch or even 6-hour stretch can be a big deal for a new mom as far as
Absolutely.
Getting some sleep, nutrition, exercise. Anything to add to that list?
Even getting help in the home just to keep things straightened up and neat can make a huge difference in easing mom's stress level.
So through family members or friends or spouse, whoever's around, if they're kind of aware of that.
Right. And I think one of the things that in our culture is we've gone to the nuclear family. We live in our own homes. We usually don't have parents come in for very long after a baby's born. And so motherhood becomes this very isolating experience. And if you're feeling these feelings of depression or anxiety, or you're feeling guilt that you're not doing it right or good enough, by ourselves, those seem to just intensify and roll because we don't have anybody to bounce off to say, oh, yeah, I felt that way too. Oh, yeah, you know what? That passes. You're going to be okay. If you're not hearing the message, you're going to be okay. You start to wonder if you're ever going to be okay again, or can you really be a mom? And for a woman that wanted to be a mom or believes that this is what she's meant to do, that can be devastating.
That somehow it's not fitting into their identity as they thought it would or should. Again, kind of going back to that guilt complex of, you know, this is what I've always wanted. This, I should be enjoying this. I should, you know, love this. And then feeling badly when they don't have those natural feelings.
Right. And so if a mom can find a support group with other moms, whether that's a breastfeeding support group or just a general mothering support group, or even one that focuses on depression, because we have all of those different support groups in many communities, it can be a huge help just to feel you're not alone, just to hear that what you're feeling is normal. Moms are feeling it all over the place. And I think it's unfortunate that we've created it to be so isolating for moms, because it's hard.
Right, and you mentioned the family's support system. A lot of people live away from their families, so even if the families are coming in, they're coming in for maybe a few days or a week at a time. They're not really able to stay for long, extended periods of time.
Right, so pretty quickly, mom is back to having to cook dinner, clean the house, take care of this new baby, and there's the sleep deprivation, there's the adjustment to motherhood, just normal, the change in relationships. And so there's a lot going on.
And many times taking care of other children as well, if this isn't the first pregnancy.
Right.
So you mentioned medicine. Where do you see that playing a role for people who choose that route?
Medication is a great option. It works well and it works quickly. And when you have a good clinician who understands the different postpartum mood disorders, because there is depression, but there's also anxiety, there's OCD, there's post-traumatic stress, and there is psychosis. So a good clinician is able to weed out those different symptoms and make sure that the right medication's prescribed. It can be a lifesaver. Women
who
are using...
I'm sorry, can you touch on some of those different types that you're talking about and give a quick synopsis of some of those, like what is the difference between depression and anxiety and OCD and some of those other things you mentioned?
Right. So anxiety is really excessive worry is what we're seeing. And that's a mom who's constantly worrying. She feels that something bad is going to happen. You know, just cannot focus and enjoy the good things that are happening. She's focused on when is something bad going to happen. The racing thoughts, the disturbances of sleep and appetite, the inability to sit still. She may even have physical symptoms, the dizziness, the hot flashes, and the nausea. Some moms will even have panic attacks during the postpartum phase, which feel much like you're having a heart attack. So you get that hot flash, you get the heart racing, hard to get your breath. It's a really scary feeling.
Right. And then some of the other ones that you mentioned?
So you've got postpartum obsessive compulsive disorder. And normally we think of, you know, checking the lights, checking the stove, those types of things that go with OCD. In this case, these thoughts are persistent, repetitive thoughts related to the baby, and they can be frightening thoughts of harming the baby. Most moms will do things to protect themselves. So if they're thinking that they're going to drown the baby while they're giving the baby a bath, they may hand the baby off to other people and ask them to bathe the baby. So they're very protective. They realize these thoughts are not okay. And if a mom's telling you that, there's definitely medications that can help, and it's definitely treatable.
And that can be very, like you said, scary for the mom to feel like she's having those thoughts. And then I would assume also shameful, like, how could I be thinking of hurting my baby?
Right. They're absolutely terrified.
And how
they have the thoughts.
I'm assuming that some keep these thoughts to themselves because they're so embarrassed by them, or...
There's embarrassment, there's fear of Children's Protective Services getting involved, and that's one thing moms need to be aware of. When you go to a clinician and get help, you're going to have a lot less risk of Children's Protection Services getting involved because you're probably not going to act on these. Your clinician's going to be watching and making sure that things are working right. It's when they continue to go untreated that there can be problems.
Right. Well, the last one you mentioned was psychosis, full-blown.
Right, and psychosis only occurs in 1 to 2 women out of every 1,000 deliveries. So it's not very common, but it is very associated with a history of bipolar mood disorder. So a woman who has bipolar disorder should definitely be talking to a clinician, should be talking to her psychiatrist and her OB throughout her pregnancy. This is how we prevent it from happening. In this case, she has thoughts maybe of harming herself for the baby or maybe just really strange delusions, but she's not able to connect that these thoughts are not right.
So doesn't she's, have the attached like embarrassment or shame that a person like you were describing with OCD thoughts might have.
Right. And we definitely see a decreased need for sleep. A lot of paranoia and a lot of rapid mood swings. So one minute she seems okay, the next minute she seems down, then she's irritable. So we're just seeing things go all over the board pretty quickly. And a lot of times what they will have is religious hallucinations. That's kind of a key that this is definitely not okay.
Can you expound on that? What does that mean?
I don't really know how to explain it because I myself have not had a hallucination, but my clients say, it's like one of them said, I'm not religious and every dream I have is about Jesus coming to me and it's very strange. I don't understand it.
What about people who are religious and have that background? Do you see that even more or doesn't matter necessarily if they're religious or not?
I'm going to say I haven't studied that.
Okay.
So I don't know. But I do know that, you know, every one of my patients that's had psychosis has had bipolar disorder. And the ones that have had a break have not been treated properly through their pregnancy or they haven't told anybody. So getting a good team and working through it during pregnancy, in my opinion, is just critical.
Okay. Yeah, so religious hallucinations would probably be having thoughts of either grandeur, like I am God or God is on, you know, working with me, or maybe having thoughts, just like you said, of visits or visions or things that don't completely make sense, which in a religious framework can be sometimes not caught, because if somebody has a religious dream or has even a vision, like, for instance, in our Mormon culture, that can be considered a spiritual occurrence.
Right. I think, though, critically, I mean, you will notice that the mothers act differently. It's very noticeable.
Yeah. It's not comfort. It's not like they're coming to you with a spiritual, like, wow, this really happened to me and this was neat. It's more like they're acting strangely along with that.
Right. And one of my clients, she continually handed off the babies to neighbors. And her husband couldn't quite figure out why she was doing that. When we finally got to what was going on, she was afraid she was going to hurt the baby. Luckily for her, she didn't. She was having more thoughts of harming herself than the baby, and she was very protective. But when the psychosis finally came to a head, she just wanted the baby out of her way. She didn't want to deal with the baby. She wanted to deal with herself. It was really very scary. And you'll notice their judgment. I mean, it goes a lot with what would be considered in bipolar, a lot of impulse control issues. So buying clothes they don't need, going out to see people they don't need to see, buying, purchasing things that make no sense, that they don't need, just to buy them. So you kind of see behaviors that are along that impulse or compulsive type behaviors.
So going back to the medications, for most, you know, most people, like you said, only 1 to 2 per 1,000 will fall into more of the more serious ailments. For most who have postpartum depression or anxiety or even some of the OCD thoughts, you're saying that medications can be very much a helpful part of their treatment. Do you get the concerns that I hear often, which is, well, how will this affect my baby if I'm still breastfeeding? Or some people are choosing to be on antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds during the pregnancy. How's that going to affect my fetus? What all do you know about that, and what can you share with us?
So the research shows that the antidepressants that are used today, known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or SSRIs, are very safe during pregnancy and breastfeeding. There are a couple that are contraindicated or not recommended, but most doctors are well aware of those and can prescribe the preferred medications. And those medications seem to work very well. What we know is that most of the medications are safe during breastfeeding. Only a small amount will pass through the breast milk. And the long-term studies at this point do not show negative effects on the baby.
So that's pretty important information for women who really, from what I see, their anxiety is very much about this, not wanting to harm the child in order to treat themselves.
Right. And what we know is that when a mom is depressed, it affects her and the baby. It affects the entire family. She has a very hard time functioning. She's not connecting to the baby. So if you don't do anything to treat it, you're also putting your child at risk. So it becomes really looking at the benefits and risk. I mean, if you're really not wanting medication, then you need to take seriously the suggestions for taking care of yourself and making sure you're getting exercise and eating well and just reducing your stress level in every way possible to try and help yourself. But sometimes even all those do not work because it's a chemical imbalance in the brain. And the bottom line is not everybody can shift it on their own, and that medication can be a lifesaver.
Do you see a lot of resistance to that type of an idea that this isn't something I can fix on my own or that I should will myself better? Do you see people having a better understanding about depression, or do you still see a lot of that, those stigmas attached to people seeking treatment and wanting to go on meds, for instance?
I think initially there's a lot of stigma, but as women learn that it is a chemical imbalance, it's not something that they can control or will to go away. As they understand that better, and as they understand that the purpose of medication is to help the brain heal and to get better so that it's in balance again, that it reduces significantly.
So a big part of this is education then, as far as educating the mom, educating, I'm sure, the spouse who many times has similar concerns, and even at times educating family or friends who may put forth criticism or judgment when they hear that the woman has gone on medication or is seeking some type of treatment.
Right. Because we would never tell somebody who has cancer or diabetes, don't take the meds. That's not, you can just make yourself better. We know they can't make themselves better. It's a physiological thing. The same thing is true for mental health. If people could will themselves better, they would in a heartbeat, because I don't know anybody who likes feeling this way.
Yeah.
But in the end, yeah. And so why would we tell somebody who has an imbalance in their brain, don't take the medication that can make you feel better, that can get things rebalanced for you? And a woman taking medication should look at thinking about 6 months on it to allow things to get back into balance, and then working with her team to slowly come off it if that's her choice. Some women stay on it much longer because they find it makes a huge difference for them. They may have been suffering and never really been able to put a word to it or a label to it.
Meaning that they were probably suffering with depression even before the birth.
Right. And so I definitely think that, you know, all of these tools have a place, and that they're powerful in healing. And that's what we want. We want a mom and a baby who are connected. We want a family who feels good about being a family. And that just can't happen when somebody's suffering with depression or other mood disorders.
Right. What, going back to a previous question I asked, what are some case examples that you can share with us as far as, you know, there was, you know, give us a few stories.
As far as
just people you've worked with, as far as, you know, what you've seen, and maybe, you know, like this, a particular client of yours who came in and this is what she was complaining about, or these were her symptoms, and then this is what you tried or didn't try, and now, you know, what were the results?
So I had one mom who came to me saying shortly after the birth, she'd had kind of a rough birth, quite frankly, due to some hospital policies and things that were going on, some emergencies. She was delayed 4 hours on getting her epidural, and she had planned for an epidural. So that was a pretty big deal that she had to go through 4 hours of labor with no medication. But after the birth, she just had a very hard time. She kept calling me saying, I'm confused. I can't remember what I'm supposed to do for the baby. And this was before I'd had a lot of training, and I knew it didn't sound right. I just didn't know what it was. And at one point, we found out that she had been unmedicated for 7 years for bipolar disorder, and it had kicked in full-blown in postpartum. So she just had a lot of confusion. Like she was telling me, I write down what time I'm supposed to feed the baby. I write down what time to change him. I write down what room he's in because I can't remember. Which does sound strange, and we sent her to her OB, who really was not familiar with postpartum mood disorders, unfortunately, and did not prescribe the proper medication to help her soon enough. Which is, again, why it's really important to choose clinicians who are skilled in reproductive mental health.
Yeah, which is interesting. You think that that would just be part of the norm of an OBGYN to be skilled in that area, but you're saying that that's not always an area of expertise, is the mental health part of the OBGYN field.
Right. Which was why a lot of them now are connecting with either a mental health counselor or a psychologist to pair up with, because that's the group that has more experience with this and more knowledge.
So how is this particular woman's issues resolved, or were they?
She had to be hospitalized at one point, but she is doing very well now. She was able to take medication. She is still on medication and doing very, very well.
You mentioned briefly, I think when we were talking about the different types of disorders, you had also mentioned trauma. And I know that was one of the questions one of our posters on Mormon Stories asked about, is when is trauma, past trauma, especially if, you know, if you've had somebody who's grown up with either sexual or physical abuse or even a lot of emotional abuse, and now they're in the role of being the parent, how often do you see that becoming part of the issue with postpartum as well.
About 1-6% of women will experience what's called postpartum post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's really recently that this has come to be a disorder that's been taken seriously, really. What happened was for a long time we were using the Edinburgh, and the Edinburgh is fabulous. It has a very good rate of picking up postpartum depression and anxiety, which is what it was designed for. However, a lot of the symptoms a mom with post-traumatic stress disorder has are also similar to depression. So they'd be labeled as depressed, or it wouldn't show up on the Edinburgh because it wasn't assessing the right things. So what we know now is that there has to be different tools for moms that seem to be having symptoms, which would be re-experiencing that traumatic event. So that would probably be the childbirth itself. And so they just can't get it out of their mind. They just keep feeling it, seeing it over and over again.
The trauma of the childbirth.
Right. They might have flashback nightmares.
About the childbirth itself.
And that would not be uncommon, again, relating to the childbirth itself.
Okay. So that's a little bit different than from if you're coming into motherhood with your own traumatic past experiences.
Right.
Versus you're talking about the childbirthing experience being a trauma in of itself.
So there is what's known as postpartum traumatic stress disorder following childbirth. And then there's some women who will enter the childbearing year with experiences of sexual abuse or child abuse that can definitely impact their experience.
And what do you see as far as that? What kinds of things are you seeing to pick up on that?
As far as childhood sexual abuse?
Yes.
So a mom who has been sexually abused may re-experience a lot of her trauma during the birth. There's a lot of very invasive procedures that occur during childbirth, from putting an IV in, which definitely is invasive and going into somebody's veins, to routine cervical examinations. And those can be very difficult for women who have experienced sexual abuse. And if they're not open about their experience or willing to talk to medical staff about that, then the staff doesn't know and they go on as normal. And a lot of the things they do can be very difficult for the sexual abuse survivor.
Almost re-traumatizing then. And then I assume once the birth is over, they're dealing with those emotions and feelings for a long time after the birth.
Right. And so I think this is where a doula who has a background and the experience in understanding childhood sexual abuse or child abuse can be immensely helpful in planning and preparing.
Was that part of your training, or is that extra training that a doula would have to look for?
I have done extra training on childhood sexual abuse.
Okay.
There is advanced doula trainings on it. You can ask a doula what training and knowledge she has in this area, because there are a lot of great tools for planning ahead and preparing and helping a mom to get ready. I say too, if she hasn't had any counseling around this, this is a great time to do it, because birth can be very healing. It can be re-traumatizing when a mom's not prepared, but it can be a very healing and empowering experience for a well-prepared mom.
Yeah, and in my experience with working with past trauma, especially when it's sexual abuse, is that many people I see are not really coming to deal with those issues or to talk about those issues until, you know, they're in their late 30s or 40s. So they've gone through a lot of their child rearing experiences without having addressed some of those issues. I think maybe because of some of the shame or stigmas or embarrassment or not wanting to talk about those things. It's a coping mechanism in of itself to protect oneself, is to not talk about it.
Right. And if it's happened within the family, which is a high amount of the sexual abuse we see, unfortunately, there's even more reason to keep a secret or to feel ashamed or even maybe guilty that you had part in it. And that's very difficult for women. So I think the more we talk about it and address it, the better it is.
Right. Well, that's very interesting. Hopefully listening to things like this can help women kind of normalize those kinds of situations for themselves and understand that getting help is definitely an option and they don't have to do it all alone. Shame doesn't have to be.
Just knowing there's counselors who will listen.
Yeah.
Who aren't there to judge it. We're there to help you work through it.
Right. Okay, so we talked a lot about medicine. We talked a lot about kind of just some, you know, general things that most people kind of know intrinsically anyway, just kind of like the exercise and getting sleep and good nutrition. Are there any other maybe more holistic approaches that you recommend with when it comes to any of these types of things we've been discussing?
There are chiropractors that can help with herbs and chiropractic. Some people find that can be very helpful. I mean, but basically those are what we have available right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So just being willing to look at each individual with kind of a treatment approach, that some of the things may work for one person that may not work for another, and each individual having their own treatment plan per se.
Absolutely.
What about helping spouses and our family members understand all these things and getting them on board? Do you have any ideas for successful ways of going about that?
Postpartum Support International has awesome information for friends and family on their website, which is postpartum.net. And it's just a wealth of information. And I believe there's even a book called Postpartum Dads. That's awesome.
Okay. Great. Those are great resources. We'll try to link to some of those as well from Mormon Stories. Now, since this is Mormon Stories, how often are you finding yourself working within the LDS population? Is that much of your clientele or not so much?
That has not been much of my clientele.
So then within the Mormon culture, just from your own maybe personal experience, what do you see specifically within our belief systems or traditions or maybe cultural aspects that might exacerbate this problem or that may make it difficult for people to reach out when it comes to postpartum depression?
We definitely idealize motherhood. But I think as a general culture, we do that as well. But there's a lot of emphasis on this is what we're meant to do. This is what we're meant to be. And when things come crashing down, that can be really hard. Because it feels like maybe it's a personal failing rather than our body having a hard time adjusting to shifts in hormones and shifts in what's going on.
So now a normal bodily procedure turns into a spiritual failing.
Right. Or, I mean, unfortunately, I've heard advice to just pray more or read your scriptures more, which could be great advice. But if we have a biological problem, we've got to get to the root of that in order to get it solved. It won't solve it on its own.
And maybe from within the culture, then also not just the mother struggling with these feelings, but the rest of us looking at somebody who is struggling and making those types of assumptions. Well, they're just not spiritually in tune enough or strong enough, or if they would only be doing those are kind of judgments that maybe others pass that need to be checked by all of us as a culture at large.
Right. And for a lot of women, they have husbands in bishoprics or stake presidencies. And I've heard them say, you know, they have an image to uphold. And so falling apart in their mind doesn't fit that image. And so they try to hold on and hold on and hold on until it all falls apart. And then it's just really hard.
Because it's much harder to get the treatment you need the further along you are versus doing more preventative work.
Right. And by the time, and the more you wait, the more it's impacted that entire family unit, which of course can lead to the kids having problems. It can lead to the couple having problems, ending in divorce. You know, there's just things that can happen when we don't treat these disorders.
Right. What about the other side of that? What do you see maybe some of our doctrines or teachings that might be useful in this type of setting?
you know, when relief societies were working well, there's a lot of support for moms within the church. And that can be a great source of support. A relief society president who has a listening ear or who recognizes that maybe some extra help is needed can be huge, because that help can come from within the culture, within the group, and it can be done very lovingly. And so I think that can be a huge strength when things are working right. I think, you know, visiting teachers who can come in and pop in and just see that something's not quite right can be huge. We have that built-in safety feature. We also have each other. I mean, if things are going well and a woman feels connected to her group and she feels accepted, there may be a safe place to actually talk about these things.
Right, which hopefully more and more women can start doing, because I don't think that this is something that is an isolated event here or there. I think this is actually probably somewhat common for people in a ward. There should be at least two or three or four people that maybe have had similar experiences.
Right. And so if you can find those connections and we can help each other, it can be very powerful.
So moving beyond culture, what about, you know, doctrinally itself, what do you see as far as our belief systems that could help a woman or her family that's struggling with this?
You know, I believe that our belief in God and in a kind and loving God is huge. If you can believe that somebody's rooting for you to get better and to do better, that's a huge part of it. You know, when we don't believe that there's somebody to turn to, it can be very difficult.
Or when maybe your perception of God is more rigid than that of a loving, unconditional God.
That can be difficult then.
Yeah. Right. So a lot of that has to do with our own perceptions and relationship with whatever it is we see as the divine. Well, this has been very helpful information. I really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything else that we've missed or that you'd like to touch on before I guess, close up here?
I do want to say that one way that women can help themselves is the research shows that having, and I'm going to sound like I'm promoting myself, but having a doula really reduces the risk of the post-traumatic problems, the postpartum depression. Having someone who can guide you through this experience can be very, very helpful. And there have been, I think the last research study I read said there had been 14 studies with 5,000 women involved.
Yeah,
so that's
huge
great. Benefit, you know.
Right. Well, and like you said, the main role of the doula being that of educator and advocate, I think that those are two things that just can be so helpful in anything, but especially within a birthing process. So I think that's, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about what services you offer, and if people are wanting to use you as a resource, how can they best do that?
I am a birth and postpartum doula, so I help moms through both phases. I do in-home support services, and I do help them through. I'm there for the labor and delivery, however long that takes. Basically, I do talk to people on the internet who want some extra guidance and help. You can find me at www.parentscount.com.
Okay. And if they want to find a doula maybe more geographically close to them, are there any type of listservs or places where people can go that are recommended to find a certified doula?
There's doulamatch.net. And there is dona.org. And I think to labor is tolabor.com. Let me check that for you.
And
I
all
should
of
have been
those.
More prepared.
Oh, that's okay. All of those sites will have kind of links to geographical resources.
Right, to their certified doulas. So it is tolabor.com.
Okay. Well, Jamie, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this information with us. I think that it's been very educational and hopefully helpful to our listeners.
I hope so.
Okay.
Thank you for letting me come on.
No problem. We'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.